And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us and sticking with us. And especially, I was going through the roster, going through the shows that we've done, trying to come up with, wanted to generate some new interview ideas. And I was looking, it'd been a while since we'd had this guy on. And he's one of, well, he's my go-to guy. Like I said, he's only one of three sources, and the other ones are just a couple subscription services. But we think enough of this guy's services to actually hire him as a consultant. So it'd be best to get his macro view and tell us what's going on in the big economic world, the big economic picture. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Chase Taylor to the show of Pinecone Macro Research. Chase, thanks for joining us, man. It's been a while, huh?
Yeah, it's always great to be on. It's my favorite show out there, so I appreciate having me on.
Thank you for saying that. That only cost me $150 to have him say that. so Chase, you're on the road, man. You're a brave soul, an intrepid soul. You are in San Antonio, making your way across the continental United States with two dogs, a baby, a wife. Is it hot? Is it hot in San Antonio right now?
It's going to be 80 today.
And that's not bad. Okay.
Kind of wet.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. See, I'm in Phoenix, so I'm thinking every place
we were there like 2 days ago. So.
Oh, there you go. Well, and that's the thing about growing up in Seattle, right? When it's hot in Seattle, you just automatically assume it's hot everywhere because it has to be, right? Then you come down here to, you know, vacation in Phoenix, and you think the same way, and you go, no, I'm in the middle of the desert. It doesn't necessarily have to be hot other places. But anyway, man, a lot going on in your world and your research, I'm sure. Let's just take it from the top. What are you seeing here on a U.S. level? What is changing in the macro picture since the last time we spoke? What are things looking like coming out of emerging markets? I guess kind of give us that overall global view right now, the things that are really catching your eye, and I guess we can just drill down from there.
Sure. So the last time I was on the show, just to kind of recap on that, what I was talking about was I thought 2021 would be just a huge economic boom in the U.S. And I kind of thought, you know, we might have equity markets at some point have issues with that if bond yields, you know, got high enough. And then I thought, you know, maybe 2022, we could start kind of rolling over, going back the other way, especially with inflation. Because I figured inflation would pop up to 3%, 4%, maybe even 5%, you know, this year. And, you know, right now, I think the biggest macro argument is, yeah, of course we're going to have inflation, but is it going to stick around? And there's definitely two distinct schools of thought on that. And I think, personally, I think both have merits. I think we're going to eventually get to, you know, a secular turn in inflation, but I don't necessarily think, you know, the one we're getting right now is that one, but it could be. I think that all really hinges on what happens with labor. Everyone kind of focuses on a lot of these supply constraints, and, you know, short term, we should be doing that. The cost of shipping, the cost of lumber, you know, all these things we keep hearing about in headlines. But what really is going to matter is, you know, a year from now, what is going on with wages? If wages are really starting to pop, then that inflation can stick. And if that happens, a lot of people are offsides. And just so people understand, I think everyone kind of looks at it as like, oh, everyone expects inflation now, but not really true. If you look out into the future, you know, and look at bond markets, everyone seems to be thinking, and inflation expectations, you know, moving forward, that we're going to get a bunch of inflation this year and then it all goes away like forever again. And that I don't think is going to be correct. I think it's going to be stickier than people expect, even if it's not hyperinflation or really high inflation that sticks around the way some people seem to think. The most interesting thing in macro right now, really the last week or two, maybe three, is the fact that data keeps coming in really hot. You know, inflation growth still looks great, but bonds are kind of rolled over, so yields are starting to fall back down even though we're getting hot data. And that is by far the most interesting thing out there, and there's multiple ways to look at it. Everyone has their own opinion, and I'm kind of open to different ideas on that. It could be multiple different things. It could be, you know, some people think this is going to get so hot that the Fed has to kind of break the cycle, so that, yeah, we all, you know, this inflation and growth kind of ends this year because all of a sudden, or next year, because the Fed has to kind of play catch up on rate hikes. And some people just think that all that inflation was already priced in and we already got the bond move. So we'll see. We'll see which one of those is true. But I, as you know, I kind of told clients about a week ago, like, hey, I'm just getting out of all my short treasury positions because it just started looking ugly on the chart, looking like it wanted to roll over. And sure enough, it has. And now we're kind of at a weird spot where it's hard to see which way that's going to go moving forward.
Hey, interject here for a second, because people that listen to the beginning of the show will probably think that we coordinated, because I literally started talking about the rates and the 10-year. And I also laid out to them how I am much more careful about assigning reasons or catalysts for moves. But I have been scratching my head looking at that move in yields on the 10-year and thinking to myself, who is stepping in here buying? Then I see, and again, I think all too often this gets, you know, it becomes like a boogeyman of sorts that the Fed is behind everything.
But kind of a real one, yeah.
Yeah, but kind of a real one, right. So their balance sheet expands by $86 billion in the last 7 days. Have you looked at the details of that? Were they buying up 10 years, or do you know what they were buying?
So I haven't dug into exactly what they're doing, but really for the last probably 6-8 weeks, they've been buying way more than the kind of, you know, prescribed amount that they said they would be buying, which is exactly what I would have done if I was them. Like, if yields are going to get a little out of control, or, you know, especially the yield curve starts moving in a way you don't like, why not just go buy extra without even announcing it or talking about it, hinting at it? Nothing. They haven't talked about it. They just gone out there and bought more to get yields down, I think. Because supply is huge, just, you know,
right.
Just like months. So,
well, no, they just remind me of like a clown juggling, right? And just people just keep throwing them more balls, you know.
Exactly.
You're just looking around now, going, is there a part of this market that they're not touching? Is there a part of this market that they're not influencing? Right. You know, they want inflation.
Wow, we have the best growth in decades, too.
Yeah, I know. And they're just going to keep. And you and I know, again, it's no surprise. They have to. And this has been the argument that we've been making all along. And it's funny, again, that you started off that way, because I was just tying up our quarterly report to our clients. And I said, look, you know, you're going to hear a lot of arguments about deflation on one side, inflation, and both camps have great backing, right? They both have great reasons, great logic. I can see a lot of merit to both arguments. Personally, I see this like being a tug of war between deflation and inflation. You know, I think you're going to see pops of both. I think you're going to see deflationary wafts hit because of the overhang, you know, because you and I know the underlying structure, especially corporate balance sheets, are ugly. And then you'll probably see a Fed response, and you'll see a waft of inflation. Is that kind of the scenario you're looking at, one way or the other? Just because I think, you know, you and I have seen it so much over the cycle that the inflationistas come out and go, oh, it's starting now. And the deflationists come out, oh, it's starting now. And it never gets fully one way or the other. Do you think that tug of war is going to continue, or do you think we're going to break one way or the other here?
Short term, I think it's tug of war, and it all comes down to, well, I mean, I talked about wage inflation earlier, but at the end of the day, this all hinges on fiscal policy. So one thing that is interesting to me that is definitely counterintuitive is about the same time that the Senate parliamentarian told the Senate that they could go ahead and use reconciliation an extra time this year, which maybe they could do infrastructure that way, is about the time that bond yields peaked. And that's fascinating to me, because that to me suggests, you know, that more growth, more inflation, because we're going to spend, you know, an extra, call it $1 trillion, than we would have been able to if they had to do it on a bipartisan basis. So that part is interesting. But at the end of the day, I still think fiscal drives everything. And really, I think now, you know, the Fed monetary policy is sort of like riding in a little sidecar on the giant motorcycle that Congress is driving at this point. And most people still really haven't figured that out, I think, on Wall Street, that Congress is where policy lies these days, not really the Fed. They're going to monetize what they have to monetize. They're going to more or less do what they're told by Congress, or what they have to do whenever. I mean, you're seeing that now. You have a month with, you know, enormous treasury issuance, and they go out and they buy a ton of it because they just have to. So really illustrates that fiscal is the dominant policy now, not monetary. So when it comes to this, you know, race between inflation and deflation, and just how much is Congress going to spend and where are they going to put it? And the reason I am more of an inflation, you know, leaning person, especially in the next decade, is since Biden has been elected, they have really put a lot of money into the hands of regular people instead of, you know, the banks and corporations and, or, you know, super rich people that won't go out and spend it. And, yeah, working class people, you give them a big pile of money and they'll go out and spend it. And their propensity to spend on things that are commodity intensive and is just so much higher than, you know, if I give Jeff Bezos a few grand, he's just, you know, it's just going to go into his investment ether. It's not like he's going to go buy, you know, his eighth yacht or whatever. So I think when you look at it that way, if they are able to keep putting money in, then they're already talking about more stimulus packages if growth doesn't make them happy enough. And if they do that and it goes to regular people that will actually spend the money into the economy, then we keep getting inflation and all the deflationary arguments to me kind of melt away.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's certainly the, I look at kind of more from a behavioral finance or behavioral economics standpoint, which is they're so far down this path that, you know, inflation to me is the inevitable outcome, that they're going to keep pushing that button until that button breaks. And the reason they're going to keep pushing that button is because it works, right? I mean, so every time markets start going haywire, you know, they push that button, they calm everything down, they get asset prices going in the right direction or right to them, which is up. Ever higher, right? And you know it works, right? It's like, why do people do it? You know, it's the old Jesse James. You know, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is, right? Why do they keep printing? Because it works. And I just think it's kind of that natural. And every time they do it, I also think that it further entrenches them, right? That they make themselves more indispensable to the market, and those
they're definitely pot committed. Yes.
Yeah. Right. And so they're just going to keep pressing that button until something breaks. And I think that the WAFs or the warning signs, if you will, of deflation are just going to spur more fiscal spending. And the, like you said, so kind of, and it makes sense. Is this what you're saying? Which is, yeah, the Fed's going to take action, but the Fed's going to be prompted by the Treasury essentially. Right.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the old military saying beatings will continue until morale improves. I kind of think, you know, fiscal will continue until inflation improves. It's just the way it is. I mean, because if you know, I think a lot of deflationists, they have interesting arguments about, you know, QE's ineffectiveness and that it's deflationary, not inflationary, things like that. Money printing doesn't get out of the system, so it stays deflationary. And I think, you know, there's definitely an element of truth in all of that, but I think what is kind of implicit in those ideas is that there is a free lunch. If you're telling me that, you know, the Fed can, if the Treasury can just run $50 trillion in the next 5 years of deficits and we can just, you know, remake every building in the country, you know, and if we could just throw $50 billion every minute at, you know, new semiconductor plants so that we can catch up with Taiwan or whatever the case may be, and you know the Fed can just print money to cover all of that and there won't be any inflation because, you know, QE is deflationary and it doesn't get out of the system, then you're telling me there is a free lunch, that we could do anything and never get inflation. And like I just feel like that's kind of obviously not true. So there are levels of fiscal where you're going to get inflation. At the same time, you know, a lot of inflationistas are going overboard right now because a lot of what's happening now is just year over year comparisons and, you know, supply constraints because of coronavirus that chopped production for a lot of goods over the last year. And it just hasn't caught back up yet. So when all that does catch back up, these ports clear out, things like that, then a lot of that inflation is going to go away, and the deflationists are going to be able to kind of pound their chest and say, told you so, and they're not going to be completely wrong. But, you know, when we look out 1, 2, 3, 4 years ahead, and all of the coronavirus effects are just kind of out of the system, and it's not as confusing to look at the data. If Congress is still running giant deficits and giving it to regular people, I still think that creates a lot of inflation. And at the end of the day, it's the only way out of where we have put ourselves anyway.
Yeah. No, it's certainly certainly there's a, like I said, there's an, and there has been since the beginning, but an air of inevitability to all of it, just because, again, you understand, you know, when countries begin down this path, which they've done before, nobody's ever turned back, because you can't structurally. And it's to say it'll be interesting. I mean, it's going to be the financial story of our lifetimes, how we manage this, how we move on from this. What are you seeing going on, more of the global picture? You know, what are you seeing out of emerging markets? What are you seeing out of different places like that? Any interesting things going on in the world that have caught your eye?
So, as you know, I like Japan. I've liked Japan for a long time now. Still do. It still looks pretty good to me. The place no one seems to like, and I think is kind of perking up and looking good lately, is Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And most people are asleep to that. When I look at emerging markets, they look really indecisive, most of them. I like Southeast Asia. There's a lot of countries that just have, you know, brilliant futures. So whenever you can catch them, you know, breaking out, then those make sense. But when I look at most emerging market, you know, indexes, it's so China heavy, and I just don't really like putting money to work in China personally. So I ignore a lot of that. And most of that is just waiting for the dollar to make up its mind which way it wants to go, because the dollar's been kind of sideways and indecisive. So emerging markets aren't going to really clarify until the dollar clarifies. And, you know, with the COVID situation in the U.S. being significantly better than places like Brazil, India, that also makes it kind of hard for emerging markets to kind of get up off the floor. Whereas, I mean, you could say the same for Europe, and that's why, you know, the U.S. continues to outperform Europe. But that should start to the pressure on that should start to relieve as Europe kind of starts getting their act together with vaccines.
And another interesting, now I'm just throwing this one in there in the mix, Tia, but I can't remember when I came across it. It was yesterday. I got to ask Chase about this. I shouldn't say I was surprised, because I'm not. I just found it humorous that China saw an uptick in buying. I mean, I don't think that they bought anywhere near enough treasuries to explain what has been going on in rates for the last 2 or 3 weeks. But they bought some new treasuries. They were a net buyer for the first time in about 2 years, weren't they?
Yeah, and it makes sense. I mean, you think about the trade deficit. They've been selling us so many, you know, durable goods, because that's all we were buying during the pandemic. So the trade surplus went nuts for them. So they have to recycle some of that back into the U.S. And then you consider, you know, our yields kind of took off and got pretty attractive to foreign investors. So you had a lot of Japanese investors buying treasuries, and then you had some official, like, central banks buying. So yeah, China definitely kind of ticked up their buying, as well as a lot of even Europe. They can make some money on treasuries these days. So we got a wave of a foreign demand for treasuries, which is another reason that we have cooled off there. There's just so much buying coming in, and a lot of it's, you know, trade surplus related, but a lot of it also is just the yields creeped up high enough to where it was profitable to, you know, dump your local treasury. You dump your local bonds to go buy some treasuries.
Yeah. What about another one that I wanted to talk to you about was uranium. A lot of interesting things going on in the uranium markets. This is a trade that has taken off, obviously, in the last year. Of course, I don't know much. I don't know. The only thing that's gone down steadily over the last year, I think, has been volatility. But it's a trade that you and I have been talking about for quite a while, years. That is certainly taken off. I wouldn't say that I'll defer to you, but I wouldn't say that we're fully in a bull market. We've got the makings for the beginning of one. Where are we at on the uranium side of it? And the other thing that you've pointed out is some really interesting actions that uranium companies are taking. And I wonder if you wouldn't elaborate on that a little bit and tell us what's going on in that market.
Yeah, so I'll start with that. I've been in uranium bull for like 5 years, and it's made decent returns, and most of that in the last year. So it hasn't been a blockbuster trade to this point, but I think a lot of the fundamentals and the story are starting to line up. And the last point you made there, it's kind of interesting. It's nothing that anyone, I think, has ever really seen before, but producers are actually raising money to go out and buy physical uranium and kind of in the open market, which is interesting. you know, it's kind of dilutive, but it's also kind of great for an investor to know that the, you know, these companies that aren't producing it at least have some uranium exposure on their balance sheet instead of just, you know, dollars hanging out. But that's getting us, we're able to see how tight the spot market is with that. So, you know, for listeners that don't follow uranium closely, the big part of the market is contracted out. So it's just, you know, your utilities go out and they buy uranium on long-term contracts at like a fixed price. But then you have a secondary market that has multiple different sources. And that secondary market, after the Fukushima kind of wrecked nuclear power in the world, that secondary market was huge. The surplus and overhang was just massive. And we've been working our way through that the last few years. And now the spot market, it appears to be getting pretty tight. And whenever we have these, and there's a lot of smaller promote-y type companies even that are going out and buying physical uranium. But now that we're seeing that, it's showing us that market has tightened up, because you're seeing a price response every time one of those announcements come out. But within the last week, that's cooled off. You know, we kind of peaked out at $30 a pound, and it's just really, really, we stayed there, $29.30. So we're going to have more of that. And the price isn't going to really take off until we get another big contracting cycle and get those long-term contracts locked in. But the longer we stay in this malaise where the uranium price doesn't explode higher, the bigger the bull market is going to have to be years in the future, because the uncovered demand into the future is just enormous. And nobody's going to put a lot of money into a project to mine uranium at the current price. So we have to have the prices before we can get the production. And until that happens, that future gap is just going to get bigger and bigger, which means the price explosion will just have to be bigger and bigger. It's a weird convex trade that you just don't see in other commodities.
Yeah, but would it be wrong to infer, and I haven't dug into this deep enough to understand, and I am not a uranium expert, but would it be okay to infer, safe to infer, from the actions of some of these producers buying up supply in the open market, they must think that, I would imagine, again, would it be okay to infer that they must believe that this, they've got to be right at the tail end of this glut? I wouldn't see them throwing capital to purchase this stuff on the open market if they didn't think that they were right at the edge of this thing.
Yeah, I do think that's fair to say. And I think there have been some signals that they're right. Cameco, which is the largest producer in the West, has kind of made it clear that they've struggled at times to piece together buys in the spot market. They have an enormous mine that they've closed for, you know, most of the last year. So they've had to go out and buy on the spot market to fulfill their contracts. And they've made it clear in some of their letters that it wasn't easy. And I think there was some reports coming, and I don't know if they're true, but coming out of one of these producers that was just buying in the spot market. And if the report's true, they had to source that physical uranium from, like, I don't know, it was like 10 different suppliers. They had to kind of put it together piecemeal because no one had, you know, enough to sell them one big slug. So, I mean, if that's true, then the spot market is very tight. But the price response, you know, is kind of flatlined at 30, which tells me that might not be true, at least not fully true. Or it's true and the market just doesn't respect it yet and it's going to have to, you know, just explode higher at some point. And I mean, anyone else's guess is as good as mine on which one of those avenues it's going to be. So I try really hard to keep a zoomed out, longer term view of this thing. And you know, I'm a macro guy, so I'm not super in the weeds on uranium either. But just supply and demand 5-10 years from now is just obviously out of balance completely. Especially one of the big drivers is a lot of nuclear plants. You know, they have a kind of an expected life of 40-50 years, and they keep getting extensions, and that's happening globally. So, you know, most like really smart and uranium investors, people that run uranium only funds, they've built out incredibly complex models that have accounted for essentially every mine in the world, every plant in the world, every future plant in the world, to kind of really get a basis of this. And most of those models are really conservative. They don't put in these life extensions for nuclear plants. They are not aggressive you know, projecting, say, new plants in China, even though China has been pretty aggressive with new plants lately. And even those conservative models suggest, you know, we have a long way to go in price to get the supply that we're going to need a decade from now, call it.
Yeah. Where do you see now, moving on from the uranium topic, I was hoping for some more, and I know this story. You and I have discussed it. I don't want to move on from the uranium topic too much, but it's just we're kind of still in that holding pattern of, yes, prices have to go a lot higher, but they're not yet. And when they do, it'll be great. In the meantime, anything could happen. But moving on to the oil markets. Now, oil, I think you and I were both big energy bulls about 5-6 months ago. And it seems like we started chewing through some of this resistance that I saw. I mean, it just that rally in oil even caught me off guard, as big of a bull as I was. I just figured there'd be more stumbles along the way, and that thing just, I mean, it looked like a tech chart, right? Just up and to the right. And it's really hit some resistance here these last couple weeks. What are you seeing in the oil world? What direction do you think we're still going higher in oil? How quick is supply coming back online? Do we have to worry about shale jumping up? Yeah, what's that oil outlook? What's the picture looking like globally?
Well, I've been an oil bull for a couple years now, and I'm still just an enormous oil bull. I think the story is phenomenal moving forward. I agree with you, though. I did expect some bigger pullbacks and some just longer consolidation periods in this bull market. Didn't get them, which was fine with me. Luckily, I traded it well. I just got super long and just held and bought all dips. And that's what I've continued to do. In this last dip we've had over the last month and a half, I just keep adding. And this week specifically, we're kind of breaking back out higher. And I think it's going to continue that way. As far as supply response goes, shale is behind the curve coming back. They are coming back. I mean, you get, you know, $60-$65 oil. A lot of shale companies can make money that way. So they're going, you know, we're going to get more and more production. But I don't think, you know, we're just going to beeline back to 13 million barrels a day in the U.S. where we came from. It's just too difficult. You look at OPEC, they're deliberately behind the curve. You know, they're coming back, but they're deliberately behind the curve. The wild card in the last, call it 2 months, has been Iran. They started really bumping up production and exports. Part of that's probably in anticipation of some of the sanctions relief and negotiations with the West again on the nuclear program stuff. I have no idea how that's going to turn out, but you know, their max is going to be 2 million barrels a day. So even if they run all the way back up to 2 million, to me, that's like the kind of thing you have to digest for a few weeks or maybe even a few months. But then you look at where demand and supply are, even with Iran back at full 2 million, and it doesn't matter. It's just a drop in the bucket. And longer term, I mean, maybe just point real fast.
Yeah, go ahead.
So longer term, I think it's really important to put this in perspective. You kind of get like a 5% production just decline naturally every year, because that's just the way oil fields work. You know, you drop a straw in it and you start sucking oil out and you have less and you just get less production. So oil requires immense investment and exploration and finding new oil and starting to produce new oil. And really the last 5 years, we just have not put that much money into it. We have not looked for oil near as hard as we used to. We haven't found as much. We haven't started producing new fields as often. And in the next 30 years, we need... So most people think we've hit peak demand. Like, we hit 100 million barrels a day, it's over. Like, that's as much as we're ever going to get. I think that is absurd, and we'll keep moving higher. You know, up 102, 103, 104, 105. Like, all that's going to happen in the next 5 years, I think, which no one's model really is ready for. So you have to get way higher prices. But if you look at the next 30 years, even if we did peak out at 100 million barrels and we stayed there, you need 7 new Saudi Arabias of production just to cover the declines between now and that 30-year from into the future. So even if we have hit peak demand, the amount of oil you need to cover that demand is enormous, and we're not investing and we're not finding new oil. So the long-term picture is incredible, and nothing is priced to reflect that, because everyone thinks, you know, we're all just going to have electric vehicles and windmills powering our house in 5-10 years, which is crazy.
You know, it's probably always been like this to some extent in you know, there's always that recency bias, you know, it's because it happens to us. It really is exhausting to me how meme-driven everything's become. You know, like the reality, the fundamentals, the numbers, it really doesn't matter, right? It's the meme. We're going to be energy independent. We're going to be carbon neutral. That's the way you got to invest. You know, and then you look at the actually underlying data and you're like, wait a second. Right? This doesn't really add up. You know, it's just funny. You know, you see it in crypto world. Everything is so meme driven. It's really amazing to me.
And the memes just run off pure extrapolation of current trends, which is just, as humans, this is what we do. And that, to me, that's what creates real opportunities in markets, is to arbitrage other people's extrapolations.
You know, it has at the same time, man. This has been going for so long that this has been in flux, or something that's been developing for a while, but it literally, the more responsible you have been and the more responsible you are, that is extraordinarily correlated to underperformance, right? Like you got to buy the memes and ride the wave in this thing, because, I mean,
they
just
create their own reality short term.
Oh, sure. My goodness.
George Soros's reflexivity theory, and we've seen it big time in the last decade.
Well, yeah, we were talking about this in the market update. And look, I don't know anything about it. I just know that it was started as a joke. Dogecoin, whatever the heck it's called. It's got a $40 billion market cap, man. It's one-fourth the size of Costco.
Wow. When you put it like that.
It was a joke, Chase.
Literally created as a joke.
Yeah. Right. Right. And it can get a $40 billion market cap. We were joking. I'm on the board of a private company that some of our accredited investors have made a small, very conservative investment in. And we were joking around because we've had great, you know, back-to-back, you know, 85% plus revenue growth years, and just hit cash flow neutral. And I looked at them and I was like, guys, I pulled up a company that literally had a lower rate of growth than we did, right around the exact same annual per year revenue that we're producing, and they're not profitable. And they got a market cap of $1.7 billion. And we were sitting there saying, shoot, man, we ought to SPAC this thing. You know, I mean, it's just the demand for this stuff is crazy to me. And the other thing, too, I was joking around with my brother-in-law about this sitting by the pool the other day, which was the thing about this cycle that has really killed me is you can tell people and demonstrate to people that something's a hustle, right? You can demonstrate to them that it's a fraud. I was looking at a company the other day that $100 million market cap. I think it's trading on like the JV of the NASDAQ or something like that. It's a single location deli that does $35,000 in revenue per year. It's got a $100 million market cap. Like you can tell. And the
just take my newsletter public.
Oh yeah, well, the chart on the thing looked phenomenal, Chase. I mean, it looked like it was a rocket ship, right? That's the thing about it to me, is that you don't even need to necessarily prove something is snake oil to scare people away. I mean, they find out it's nonsense. They don't even care about it, right? It's, well, yeah, but it's going up, man. Look at the chart. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
It's a wild world, pal. Okay, so then switching over, and this is a tough one. This is a confusing market to me. I've made money in the market. I've also lost money in this market. Nat gas. Does nat gas just go the way of oil? I mean, meaning, when shale comes back on, any upward momentum in nat gas is done. Where are we at in nat gas?
So, probably not surprising, but I'm still a giant nat gas bull as well. It's done well lately. But to your point, you know, if we get a major shale comeback, then that will definitely weigh on natural gas. But the story to me here lately in nat gas has been exports are just, right, they're just booming, and that puts a really nice floor under nat gas, even if we do start to see some production increases, you know, back in the shale areas.
I just don't want to forget to ask you this question. How do Russian-Ukrainian tensions, do you anticipate that having any – could that have like a Straits of Hormuz effect on nat gas for any reason?
No, I don't really think so. So natural gas is still sort of a regional market. It's starting to become more of a global market, but there's no like global benchmark, you know,
right?
Futures contract right now, but there are. So there's a futures contract in Asia and one in Europe that, and one in the UK and obviously in the US that you can kind of track well. And those, if one of those goes crazy, natural gas prices in Asia and Europe both had a large spike earlier. So last year, which really helped drive exports everywhere else. And the price, you know, was able to lift everywhere else. So there's now sort of an arbitrage where they start to level out because all because of LNG, more and more, you know, LNG infrastructure is being built. So that allows that US and Canada to kind of arbitrage their super low prices and go sell them where you get a giant price spike when, say, Japan runs out of gas kind of the way they did, you know, last year. And the more we get extreme weather events where you get really hot and really cold issues, which I think is very possible, then you just get more of that. And that also helped put a floor under price.
Didn't I see something, and I could be way off, but didn't I see something like one of Buffett's investments or one of Buffett's companies is building big natural gas power plants down in Texas in response to what occurred down there?
So I know they offered Texas to go in and really beef up natural gas production and infrastructure, essentially where they get paid like a flat rate. And then they just, if they have to surge production, you know, to cover the brownouts, then they turn it on essentially. I don't know if it's gotten any traction or it's going to happen. And I think he's actually made that offer in the past. Obviously, after what happened here in Texas, you know, a couple months ago, they need to do something different. I think renewables got a bad rap in the whole Texas thing because it was just a perfect storm where natural gas production got hit too because they weren't winterized. One of the nuclear reactors actually went down in one of the nuclear plants for a few days. So it was literally a perfect storm. But at the same time, you know, when renewables aren't enough, you really need to surge nat gas production. I suffered through some of the brownouts in Southern California last summer. So the more we go renewable, the more we see that. And obviously voters aren't really big fans of losing their electricity. So you could see a situation where that happens. And speaking of Buffett and natural gas, he has made a lot of investments in natural gas in the last 2 years.
Yep.
Over $10 billion. So And granted, that kind of a drop in the bucket to him, but not to the market.
Well, yeah, but that and that $10 billion investment, I've thought the same thing. It's not really a $10 billion investment because it was a $10 billion investment that he was buying for pennies on the dollar. I mean, that thing, it's like buying a $10 million or $10 billion call option.
Yeah, in my opinion, he picked up money on just laying on the ground.
Yeah.
But he's done it kind of. Even in, you go out to some of the Japanese investments, there's even some involvement that kind of crosses over into gas. So, and you know, when I saw the Texas news, and I haven't followed in the last couple of weeks, so maybe there's been movement on that, but it just shows you like he wants to get more and more involved into natural gas. So he clearly has a high opinion of the future of gas, but the LNG exports for the US are just exploding to new all time highs. We actually export a lot of gas to Mexico. That's firmly at all-time highs, so I don't really see that changing, that helps put a big floor under the price.
Yeah, I've long thought that, and again, I'm not an expert on this, so I could be wrong. So if you're out there and you are an expert and you're like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, full disclosure. But I've long thought that if you really want to get serious about green energy. And you really want to cut back emissions, that natural gas is going to have to be a transitionary, right, form of energy. And that if you're a long-term oil bull, it seems to me like you'd need to be a long-term oil bear because of that transition to clean energy. It seems like you would need to be, once you get the political rhetoric out of it, right? What is natural gas burns like 93% cleaner than oil or something like that? And people are like, really? And I'm like, well, think about it. You, right? You could sit there and leave your nat gas stove burning all day long and not suffer air degradation inside your house. You can't do that with oil. I mean, if you want to make a legit go at being carbon neutral, don't you have to include nat gas in that?
100%. And in my opinion, the responsible climate activist type people that want to do something about climate change, they really pound the table for natural gas and as well as nuclear. That combo, if you just made the whole world run on that combo, the amount of emissions you would cut, it would just blow your mind.
It'd be like 98% on that. You'd be like 98%.
People have done math on it. It's crazy. Yeah. And, you know, we focus on EVs, even though cars are really a minuscule amount of emissions when you look at it. But that's, you know, that's what everyone's like to focus on because they feel like that's how they can personally be involved in this or
right.
whatever. But
again, it's the narrative, right?
If you just got rid of coal, literally just got rid of coal globally and replace it with natural gas, like the amount of emissions you save there just makes up for every vehicle in the world many, many times over.
Well, and if you're all freaked out about emissions, look, and I'm all about taking care of the, I'm not saying that, right. I'm all about being responsible and doing what we can to take care of the environment. But if you're all about the emission side of it, if you converted every car to nat gas, that would be, that's way better for the environment than EVs because you're not dealing with the battery disposals. You wouldn't have to use as much oil in the production of the car by way of plastics because you wouldn't be dealing with the weight issue that comes with electric cars. The nat gas thing to me, it's so Orwellian, right? It's like four legs good, two legs bad. Oh, it's a fossil fuel, right? It's a fossil fuel. And you're like, well, yeah, but for God's sake, people, like overall, if you're really serious about this, this is a cleaner way to go than electric vehicles. Now, I think electric vehicles still have their reasons, and I think it's going to be the future. But, that resistance against nat gas has always just flummoxed me. Again, purely narrative driven, but just never really made much sense.
So, I agree. And I think it will keep gaining market share for electricity production, though. It just makes too much sense that it just almost has to.
Well, yeah.
Especially for the price.
God, I know. And we're floating on an ocean of the stuff, right?
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, we are. I mean, it's fair to say that we are to natural gas what Saudi Arabia is to oil, right?
That is fair, yeah.
Is it Venezuelan levels?
I don't know like how to like you know match up the numbers, but we have a significant amount. But what I will say is up in Appalachia, you know, where it's kind of like our sweet spot, I've seen some good analysis that where some people think that's already peaked and some people think it'll peak in call it 2, 3, 4 years. So if that happens, you know, the price really has to firm up a lot. Especially, you know, if these exports keep moving higher. And I've invested a good bit in Canada as well. They've really just started to get their LNG export infrastructure going so that they could start capitalizing on that market as well. And I think in a lot of those, the producers in Canada are just dirt cheap, just like they are in the U.S. And these things are all priced like, you know, they might make it when in reality is they're going to print money.
Right. Yeah, no, they're giving them away. I just as long as the investors are out there chasing the Doge coins, you know, pretty soon that it's gotten better, but pretty soon that capital's got to flow back to rational places. All right, well, we've already soaked up enough of your time. I know you're a really busy guy. Anything else that has caught your eye that you think we and the listeners need to know, or anything that you're keeping a really tight eye on?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I think what's really important is just keep watching is like what happens to the dollar and what happens to bond yields whenever data comes in hot. Because I think data is going to keep coming in hot. I think inflation is going to keep moving higher. And sort of seeing that reaction to it is going to be very important. It seems like the market doesn't necessarily believe that the Fed's not going to raise rates in the next 2, 3 years. And kind of watching the way that plays out, you know, if inflation really gets up 4.5, 5, something like, you know, or even, you know, 3.5, does the Fed just stay firm and say, yeah, no, we're still not raising rates. We don't care. Or do they start to feel the heat and what I kind of think could happen is the Fed sort of starts splitting where there's enough members that move, you know, their dots on the dot plot and start talking hawkishly, where you sort of see a civil war in the Fed. So far, Jerome Powell's been able to kind of herd everyone together and keep them all on the same page. But, you know, if we get 4% inflation, can he keep them all? They need to for their credibility, you know, for their new inflation targeting regime. But that's going to be super interesting. So, yeah, watch the dollar, watch bonds whenever these hot data numbers come out, especially keep an eye on the labor market. I still think we can see, you know, 750,000 to 1.5 million new jobs pretty much every month for the next 3 or 4 months. And how the market reacts to that's going to be everything. And how wage inflation reacts to that's going to be everything.
Yeah, I was joking around with somebody the other day, and we were having that inflation deflation subject, and I just said, look, it's in the long run, it's inevitably inflation. And I think you've gotten to a point now where any level of deflation or any recessionary, you know, wave or pressures or whatever, you know, I think that's starting to be seen as policy error, right? Like recessions are policy errors, right? I think they're just going to keep pressing that button, man. And I don't see any stop to it. And I think it's really funny that people are like, what are the feds? What's the Fed going to say? I don't think they're going to end this party early. I mean, they haven't, right? I mean, no. we're raging at 3 in the morning, right? We're raging at 3 in the morning still. So, I mean, they obviously haven't pulled it away. But I just think this is the classic setup for it's going to go too far this time, right? They were not going to pull the punch bowl early.
So, and I'll say one more thing on that before you let me go. But
yeah.
If you really think about what the Fed has done for the last, call it 30, 40 years, is whenever they thought the economy and inflation was getting too hot, what they essentially do is make sure some folks can't get jobs. They use unemployment to control inflation. So every time their model said, hey, we're about to get inflation, you know, you make sure people can't get jobs, and then you can't get inflation. So you raise rates and unemployment goes back up, and you make sure you don't get inflation. Well, the last few times that their model said, hey, you're going to get inflation here soon, well, let's make sure people can't get jobs. And then, but the inflation never showed up. So now they're like, oh, well, inflation's not going to show up. So we're not going to make sure people can't get jobs. We'll just let everyone get one until inflation kind of shows up and knocks on the door and, you know, well, invites itself into our home. Then we'll do something about it. So now that they've convinced themselves that inflation probably isn't coming, it probably will show up, you know, uninvited and unannounced. And what's interesting is because of all these supply constraints, you're starting to see some interesting, it's weird because you still have high unemployment, but you're starting to see some pressures on wages already. And you're seeing people say, like, we can't hire anyone. We can't find people to do this job, even though we have high unemployment. And obviously part of that is, yeah, people got a bunch of free money in the last year. But that may not be all of it. So, you know, what is the Fed going to do if we have 6%, 5% unemployment and they think they need 1% unemployment to get real inflation? Like, what are they going to do? And that's going to be really fascinating to watch.
But the Phillips curve.
Yeah. So they finally gave up on it, and it might just come roaring back to life like in a zombie movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And wouldn't that be perfect? Right.
That'll blow their mind.
Yeah. They finally give up on the Phillips curve, and then boom, it comes back. Right. Anyway,
it's at least short term.
Yeah. Right. I modern economics, man. These guys are just clowns. They're just absolute clowns. Anyway, Powell, well, hey, I appreciate it so much, especially in your busy schedule, taking some time out halfway across the country to connect with us. As always, the folks can follow you at Pinecone Macro on Twitter. Go to your website at pineconemacroresearch.com. Anything else for the folks? Did I get all that right?
That's it. Yeah, you hit it all. That's it.
All right, brother. Well, hey, once again, thank you for the time and pleasure to chat with you. And, you know, make sure you keep us up to date with any new happenings. I know that we're not going to, if it's anything like the last several years have been, which I don't see it changing, there should be no shortage of news to discuss, right?
Nope. And one last thing is precious metals are finally starting to get together.
So I was going to ask you, if your view, do we have a breakout in gold, or do you think that this is another, I mean, it's not a breakout because we're not new all-time highs, but do you think this is actionable? Is this trustworthy, or is this another head fake?
It could be either, but I'm buying it. I've been buying platinum, gold, and miners here in the last couple weeks. So I think it's going to work.
All right. If it doesn't, I'm going to bill you.
There you go.
All right,
turn
buddy.
That invoice around.
Yeah, there you go, man. All right, pal. Have a good one. Give your best to the fam, and we'll connect with you soon.
We'll do. Take it easy.
All right, you guys, thank you so much for joining us, and we've got to run, but we will be back next week. I will be back in the COVID bunker at Bulwark headquarters doing the show. Got another good interview lined up for next week, so you don't want to miss it. Anyway, have a wonderful weekend, and we will see you next week. This is the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.